Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. Coming up, members of the Israeli and Palestinian parliaments meet together in secret in Jordan and hammer out a new peace plan. Also, letters to the country's editors from soldiers in Iraq turn out to be form letters. We'll speak to a mother of a soldier who says she doesn't mind that her son didn't really write that letter. And we also speak to a father who says his son in Baghdad is sending a different message home.
He also made a quote in one of his emails, "This thing hasn't even started yet." Meaning, it's a lot crazier than anybody in America even imagined, you know.
These stories and a look at tribute CDs coming up here and now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. A U.S. military spokesman in Iraq says Saddam Hussein is believed to be influencing the resistance that's targeting U.S. troops. Major Troy Smith said there is a clear indication that Saddam has been in Tikrit recently. A U.S. soldier was killed in Iraq and two wounded today when a rocket-propelled grenade was fired at their patrol in Tikrit. Yesterday, a landmine killed another U.S. soldier. A top military official in Turkey says Turkish troops will defend themselves if they come under fire while assisting U.S. forces in Iraq. The BBC's Johnny Diamond has more from Istanbul.
Ever since the Turkish parliament granted permission for the dispatch of troops to Iraq, attention has focused on whether Iraqi representatives actually want them there. One group has made it clear that it doesn't. The Kurds, who run northern Iraq, have made their feelings well known. There's never been any suggestion that Turkish troops would patrol in the Kurdish-controlled north, but any force from Turkey, which sits on Iraq's northern border, would almost certainly be sent and resupplied through northern Iraq. It's a potential flashpoint. Turkey and the Kurds have a long simmering hostility following a 15-year-long Kurdish insurrection in the southeast of Turkey. The General Staff's words make it clear that if the Turkish army is fired upon, it will fire back.
The BBC's Johnny Diamond reporting. President Bush will take part in a number of television interviews today as part of an ongoing effort to counter criticism of the administration's policies for post-war Iraq. Mr. Bush insists that progress is being made in Iraq. Talks aimed at getting the Northern Ireland peace process back on track have ended with no real signs of progress. The leaders of Britain and Ireland were joined by political leaders from the province for the discussions in London, as Suzanne Chislett reports.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair was joined by his Irish counterpart Bertie Ahern for the discussions, which focused on restoring Northern Ireland's power-sharing assembly. It was suspended last October amid allegations of a Republican spying. Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams left Downing Street stressing he was hopeful and that he'd never believed today was make or break, while Ulster Unionist leader David Trimble appeared optimistic things were moving in the right direction.
There's been, I think, useful work done. There has been, a degree of progress, but don't ask me to quantify that. But it's not all there yet.
The deadline passes this week for assembly elections to be held in mid-November, and efforts to reach an agreement have been intensifying in recent weeks. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
Doctors in Dallas are cautiously optimistic about the condition of twin Egyptian boys who had been joined at the head but were surgically separated over the weekend. The two boys are being kept in medically induced comas to minimize swelling and bleeding in their brains. Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 93 points at 9,768 in light trading. The Nasdaq is up 18 at 1933. This is NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, stocks have moved higher today, fueled in part by Motorola's report of better-than-expected earnings. The mobile phone maker also had a positive forecast for sales in the coming months. The Dow and the S&P are now at their highest point in 16 months. The Nasdaq is at a 19-month high, having gained more than 70% within the last year. The bond market is closed today for the Columbus Day holiday. Even as Southern Californians cope with picket lines around hundreds of supermarkets, Los Angeles area commuters now face the prospect of a transit strike that could begin by Wednesday morning. For member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
After a seven-hour meeting with a federal mediator, contract talks broke off between mechanics and the Metropolitan Transportation Authority of Los Angeles County last night, just as a court-ordered 60-day cooling-off period ended. The Amalgamated Transit Union represents 2,500 mechanics and other MTA workers. Union President Neil Silver says unless something happens, we will be on strike by Tuesday night at midnight. The key issue is the union's ailing health care fund. The union wants bigger employer contributions to the fund. The MTA says it's willing to do that but wants temporary control of the fund in exchange. 3 years ago, a strike by MTA bus drivers and light rail engineers forced 400,000 LA area commuters to find another way to work. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
AOL Time Warner says the change of its name to Time Warner will become effective on Thursday. The corporate name is the same one used by the company prior to January 2000 when it agreed to be purchased by AOL for $160 billion. Since then, the company's value has dwindled, and executives who put the merger together have been forced out. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, helping disadvantaged children and their families connect to strong and supportive neighborhoods. On the web at aecf.org.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is away today. It's Here and Now. A new peace deal has been negotiated between Israelis and Palestinians, but it's already coming under heavy criticism. The deal is the result of secret, unofficial talks between Israeli activists, including some senior Labor Party officials, and Palestinian negotiators. It was brokered by Swiss diplomats in Geneva over many months, and it's said to contain at its heart a key compromise. Palestinians would get sovereignty over the Temple Mount area, and in exchange they would effectively give up the right of return for refugees. This new so-called Geneva Accord has no official standing and has been condemned by the government of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Reports say Yasser Arafat approved the secret negotiations. For more, we're joined by Dan Efron, Boston Globe correspondent in Jerusalem. Hello, Dan.
Hi.
Well, exactly who worked out this deal?
Well, these are people who are mainly outside of government on the Israeli side, people in the Labor Party who had negotiated with the Palestinians in the past, and also some Israeli peace activists. On the Palestinian side, you do see people who are a little closer to the corridors of power. One of them, Hisham Abdel Razek, was a cabinet minister in previous Palestinian cabinets. And others are close to the low-ranking or the lower-ranking Fatah activists, members of Yasser Arafat's party.
Well, how is their plan different from the U.S.-UN-sponsored Middle East roadmap?
This agreement is much more specific. It talks about where the Palestinian state will be, what Israelis will give as a compromise, what Palestinians are ready to concede, all those things that have eluded the two sides in real negotiations over the last 10 years.
And the things that the roadmap pretty much leave to the end.
That's right. And in fact, not just the roadmap. I think almost all the negotiations that Israelis and Palestinians conducted since 1993, including the Oslo deal, generally tended to push the final status issues to the end. And one of the reasons was, I think Israelis and Palestinians thought that if they sat down and tried to hash those things out right away, they would not come up with compromises. There was this notion that you need years of confidence-building measures before the two sides can sit down in a room and actually come to terms on the toughest issues. Unfortunately, confidence was not built. What we saw mainly was more settlements and more violence, and these things actually drained confidence out of this process.
Well, there's precedence for a plan worked out prior to a larger agreement. As you write, this happened prior to the Oslo Accords. But aren't some participants in this new initiative being dismissed for precisely being involved in the Oslo Accords?
Well, that's right. That's certainly what the Israeli government or people on the Israeli right say. They say that this group of people has been discredited long ago by Oslo, by virtue of the fact that Oslo broke down and did not lead to a final agreement. I think if you look at what Ariel Sharon said yesterday in response, he said that the linchpin for any agreement with the Palestinians is an end to violence. And since Yasser Arafat has been unable to deliver on that, there's no point in discussing the other issues in these talks.
That was pretty much a predictable response. So given that, who is this initiative and this agreement aimed at?
Well, it's aimed at, I think, the vast majority of Israelis and Palestinians, in other words, the majority on both sides, whom the negotiators hope are ready to put aside these years of fighting and finally come to some agreement. I think one of the things that this Israeli government keeps saying is that there is no partner on the other side, that Israel cannot negotiate with the Palestinians because Palestinians are fundamentally unwilling to compromise. I think for the Israeli left-wing negotiators in this process, this is a way of coming back and saying, no, there is a partner and there are ways to compromise, and we, Israel, should not be obstructing any real negotiation.
This plan apparently was worked on in secret for over a year. Does it have any chance?
I would say that it has a chance to be a catalyst, maybe at first for international pressure on the two sides, and maybe eventually for these two governments to start looking at it as a viable option.
Dan, thank you.
My pleasure.
Dan Efron, Boston Globe correspondent, speaking to us from Jerusalem. Letters from American soldiers based in Iraq have been cropping up in newspapers across this country, but one has raised eyebrows because the exact same draft of this letter has appeared in papers in Washington, West Virginia, and in Massachusetts with a different soldier's signature on each one. Here's an excerpt.
Kirkuk is a hot and dusty city of just over 1 million people. The majority of the city has welcomed our presence with open arms. After 5 months here, the people still come running from their homes into the 110-degree heat, waving at us as our troops drive by on daily patrols of the city. Children smile and run up to shake hands and in broken English shout, "Thank you, mister." The people of Kirkuk are all trying to find their way in this new democratic environment. Some major steps have been made. A big reason for our steady progress is that the soldiers are living among the people of the city and getting to know their neighbors and the needs of the neighborhoods.
Well, joining us on the line is Ledyard King. He's a reporter with the Gannett News Service. And, Ledyard, I know you spoke with parents and soldiers whose names appeared on these letters. What did you find out?
Well, Robin, we found out there are more questions than answers at this point. We found that there were actually 11 newspapers around the country that published this letter. We have asked the unit based in Kirkuk, Iraq, to tell us who wrote it, who disseminated it, whose idea was it, and we're still not getting clear answers on that.
And the soldiers also had different responses. Some say they signed it, but they didn't write it.
Right. One in particular said he didn't even sign it and likened the episode to cheating on a test and everybody gets the same grade. I must say, however, that all the soldiers that I spoke to and their families agree with the thrust of the letter, and that is that soldiers are doing a good job in rebuilding Iraq, but they're getting lost, or the news is getting lost, I guess, amid the unrest and killings.
Some papers refuse to print it because it's a form letter.
Yes, we talked to one paper, The Olympian in Washington, which did not publish the letter because they received two from the exactly same letter from two different people, and they were the ones, in fact, that alerted us about this. They're one of our newspapers. And I know of at least a paper in New Jersey that got two letters and did not publish the second one for the very same reason.
Well, Ledyard, thank you.
Absolutely.
Ledyard King is a reporter for the Gannett News Service. Well, now to Amy Connell of Sharon, Massachusetts. She received one of these letters from her son Adam in Iraq and sent it off to her local paper, the Sharon Advocate, and to the Boston Globe. Hello, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Amy, you first received this letter from Iraq. Did you think it was from your son?
After reading it, I realized that not his writing.
but it is. Is it his experience?
Yes, it's everything that they are doing over there, and they've left some stuff out. But it's basically everything that they are doing to tell the American people that there is good coming out of there, though there's a lot of deaths on both sides, unfortunately. Mm. And progress does take time to get things done, and America, unfortunately, wants things done yesterday, and they don't realize the time that it takes to get things corrected over there.
Well, what were you told to do with the letter?
It was addressed to our home paper, but sent to me. So it was to be put in our home paper, and then I also sent it out to Boston.
One of the soldiers whose name was also on a letter was reached by USA Today, and he said that, you know, he wasn't as comfortable with it. He agreed with the letter's sentiments, but he says, you know, it makes it look like he cheated on a test, and everybody got the same grade. Do you have any qualms about the fact that this was a form letter and part of a public relations campaign?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't look at it in that way. I think, unfortunately, we only hear the negative, and I think the positive does have to be put across to the people.
Yeah. And some might say, you know, soldiers are being soldiers. They don't really have time.
Well, that's what I had said. That's why I knew it wasn't his. They're over there. They're serving the country. They're fighting for America. They're helping the people over there get reestablished. They don't have the time to really sit down and to compose a letter like this.
So you don't feel at all used by a PR campaign. You're happy to help.
Right.
Do you get letters, Amy, from your son?
Yes, I do. And he just happened to call yesterday.
Well, so funny, because if he writes, I mean, you know, one of those letters could go in the letter to the editor.
That's true. Yeah, they could do that. Yeah. I should tell him that.
Yeah. Well, Amy, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Amy Connell is from Sharon, Massachusetts. Her son Adam is based in northern Iraq. Well, the letters Larry Harold has been receiving from his son, also stationed in Iraq, paint a different picture of what is happening there. Mr. Harold's son is a member of the Air National Guard out of Point Magu, California. He flies C-130 transport planes in and out of Baghdad. Producer Jornette Augustison recently spoke with Mr. Harold in Ojai, California, about the emails from the front.
It's a lot crazier than anybody in America even imagined, you know. It's like I'm picking up in the words that he sends is that he's just like bearing with it, you know. He's just sticking it out. He's just going to make it through. He's always been a tough, tough kid. I mean, very intelligent, but very strong. And he thinks he can make it till he can get out of there or something. But he says the morale with his buddies is just flat bottom. I mean, they all, many of them just say they want to quit, like, now. Oh, man. He said they're all wearing bulletproof vests and any protection they can because I don't know how many planes are lifting off at his base a day, but what's going on is they're getting small arms fire constantly. People are shooting at them. And when they open the back door, when they're, like, they're coming in, that's when it's really dangerous because people can just start firing away. And they get a lot of small fire. But at night, they all wear, like, you know, the infrared glasses to pick up any light so that they can immediately, they all have a button in their hand that sets off these torches that defers the surface-to-air missiles. They're hotter than the plane's engine, so that they'll send the missile off the plane. So they're all wearing these night vision goggles, and they're all just constantly peering the skies at night, watching it for any type of surface to air. And I mean, stuff like that. It's just ain't no fun, man. But the one email said that he had they dropped the door on 60. Troops came piling on that hadn't taken a bath in 2 weeks and had been eating those crummy rations and stunk, oh my God, and they were just in miserable shape, both mentally and physically. And so I guess they got them back to their base and they got the rest up or something, but I'm just getting the slight details through his wife. But the worst email was last Friday describing that now we're loading body bags. And the one line he said was that one girl couldn't weigh more than 100 pounds. And the effect that this is having on my son is hard for me to take. It's just crazy. I'm sorry.
Producer Jordana Gustafson spoke to Larry Harold about letters home from his son in Iraq. Just ahead, young filmmakers go out on the road with the Democrats running from the White House. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Presidential candidates can get to be a blur when there are nine of them floating around, as the Democrats are doing right now. But imagine getting a real up-close and personal look at the candidates on the road without ever having to leave home. Well, the Service Employees International Union contracted a group of young filmmakers to go out and tape a sort of candidate candid camera. Here's a young filmmaker talking to Senator John Kerry.
How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. Great day.
If we bring a six-pack of beer to our interview tomorrow night, would you drink one with us?
You're damn right I would. Maybe more than one.
Good news.
John Kerry, off the cuff, caught on film. Well, SEIU put these scenes together on a DVD for members as they begin to decide on a Democratic candidate. Here now is Bill Delaney spoke to two of the filmmakers. Raphael Lyon is filming Dennis Kucinich, and Aaron Rosenthal is following Howard Dean. And Bill asked Aaron if filming the candidates had changed her mind about them at all.
It definitely gave me, a much greater perspective into the whole process, which gave me a lot more sympathy for them, I think.
What do you mean?
We followed Howard Dean. We went to every single event he had scheduled in over 3 days' time, and it was exhausting. And I think that, you know, to do that on a daily basis, you know, it's a big commitment, and I gained a lot more respect for someone who's willing to take that on.
Interesting. Raphael, you spoke to many supporters out on the trail and sometimes met some pretty interesting people. Let's listen to a cut of one man talking about Dennis Kucinich.
He's people. See, what he is you just meet him, and after a while you don't feel like he's a candidate. He's just another person that's on fire. Another Martin Luther King, but it's white. John F. Kennedy, that's short.
Another Martin Luther King, only white, Dennis Kucinich. Raphael, what did you learn out on the campaign trail with Kucinich?
It was interesting. I mean, I think it was a very different campaign than a lot of the other ones. And I kind of got to see what sort of a grassroots campaign looked like with a small crew and a small staff and just a lot of adamant, really kind of enthusiastic people.
Quite a contrast to the Howard Dean campaign that Aaron's on, with money flowing in and passionate supporters everywhere he goes.
That's true, but I think it's also very much a grassroots campaign. I mean, a lot of the people that we met have only donated a small amount of money, and there definitely was a grassroots feel.
Well, Aaron, let's hear a bit of Howard Dean down at the grassroots talking to a supporter while he's apparently digging into a bowl of ice cream.
And if we're so timid and so afraid that, we should vote for No Child Left Behind, we better vote for the war because we wouldn't want to be called unpatriotic. You know, John F. Kennedy was never called unpatriotic, and he stood down the Hawks and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and wanted to invade Cuba. We got the missiles out in 12 days or whatever it was. I mean, sometimes you can be just as tough in defense of peace as you can be in defense of war.
Now, this, Aaron, is very much an off-the-cuff moment, right?
Yes, that's true.
Why do you think it's important to get that out there, these unscripted moments with these really often very heavily scripted candidates? Anybody who's ever covered a campaign knows that they say the same thing over and over and over again, these guys do.
Well, I mean, in this race particularly, it's important because there are so many candidates. But it's also, I think, it really helps to engage people who, you know, are otherwise not paying attention because they've given up hope in the political process to see such an unscripted moment, because that's when they're really real. And, you know, and you can believe a person in that moment rather than when they're giving their stump speech, you know.
Raphael, is there something unreal about a campaign like Denis Kucinich's? He's not going to be the next president.
His attitude is that if people are given a chance to listen to what he has to say, they'll find that there is a kind of bigger choice among the Democratic candidates than a lot of people are led to believe.
People say Bush got elected because he seemed like a guy they could drink a beer with. What about you?
When Lincoln spoke at Gettysburg of a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, he talked about a process that would produce somebody like me. Comes right from the neighborhoods of Cleveland, Ohio. People are going to see one of their own.
I was really impressed by a lot of the things he said, and I think if I learned anything, I learned that the media that surrounds the candidates in general like to pick one or two people to follow really closely, and that's based largely on how much money they have, and to kind of report on them in sort of a horse race manner. And I rarely turn on the news where you actually get to listen to these guys talk for more than a minute.
I'm going
to
ask you both, you're young filmmakers, young voters. Are you more cynical about the political process, campaigns, now than when you began to shoot these movies, or less cynical? Erin?
I think in seeing up close what these people have to go through, it gave me a greater understanding and ability to perceive kind of when they're giving their stump speech and when they're not. I don't think I'm more cynical. I think I feel more educated.
Raphael?
I think I'm more cynical about the process and less cynical about the people.
That's a good... thank you, Raphael, for saying that. That's what I was trying to say.
I mean, I feel like, I only followed one person, but you do get a... You know, we got to talk to all the other filmmakers. We're friends with each other. So you get to hear a little bit of more than even what we see on the films. And I think, genuinely, the vast majority of these people are good people who have, you know, and half of those people have legitimate political ideas that are, you know, they're committed to. And that's much better than I thought. On the other hand, my assumption was that, you know, when you run for president, you kind of lay out your ideas and people decide who they vote for based on their ideas. And what I found was actually there's so much more to the process than voting. There's so much more to the process of fundraising and having people report on you and being showing up in the news. And that's where the process gets really convoluted. And I feel like I have less faith in it, seeing that.
Erin Rosenthal and Raphael Lyon getting a glimpse at the human beings behind the candidates. Maybe we don't get nearly enough of that. Erin and Raphael, thanks very much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Erin Rosenthal and Raphael Lyon joined us on the line from Providence, Rhode Island.
Tomorrow in Here and Now, the Senate hears testimony about whether Muslim chaplains in the U.S. military are influenced by radical Islamic thinking. And we'll look at the thriving thrift store industry in the U.S. That's all tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the White House has 87 billion reasons for the public and Washington lawmakers to support its plan to rebuild Iraq. The question of money for Iraq goes to the floor of Congress this week and to the heartland in a PR campaign. And pop music critic Tim Riley on great tribute albums, downloading music, and the endangered music industry.
It's kind of like a huge cruise ship that has sprung 1,000 leaks. And the industry's answer is to try and go in and plug up every single leak. Get a new boat. There's no need to fix all these leaks. The leaks are irrelevant now. The boat is sinking.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Steve Brown. Saddam Hussein has been hiding in his hometown in Iraq and has been playing a part in the resistance that has been killing American soldiers on a daily basis. Lourdes Navarro reports from Baghdad.
The U.S. military says it believes Saddam Hussein has been hiding recently in his hometown of Tikrit and exerting influence within the resistance there. A senior officer with the 4th Infantry Division that operates in Tikrit says they have a strong indication that he has been operating in the area, and he left open the possibility that Saddam could be there now. The officer gave no details as to what proof they have been able to gather. Meanwhile, one U.S. soldier was killed and two others seriously wounded in Tikrit. A second U.S. soldier was killed on Sunday in a landmine explosion in Beji. One other was slightly wounded there as well. Lourdes Navarro, Baghdad.
Meanwhile, a new draft of a U.N. resolution is out today. It gives Iraq's governing council until December 15th to develop a timetable for elections and a new constitution. President Bush plans to do a series of interviews with television outlets that do not routinely cover the White House. The president, annoyed by what he calls the filter of media reporting, says he wants to make the case that the situation in Iraq is improving. Pope John Paul II is stronger than ever, spiritually, according to the Archbishop of Washington, D.C. Cardinal Theodore McCarrick is in Rome to help celebrate the Pope's 25th anniversary. McCarrick says the Pope is an extraordinary leader.
Anytime you talk about spiritual things, anytime you talk about the church and the future and young people willing to give their lives to the Lord, it lights this Holy Father up. Even though he is frail, even though he's certainly not this giant athlete who strode across the world.
In addition to his anniversary celebration, the Pope will also preside over the beatification of Mother Teresa and welcome the Church's newest cardinals. In California, businesses with large state contracts will have to offer domestic partners the same benefits that spouses receive. The bill, signed into law yesterday by outgoing Governor Gray Davis, will not take effect until 2007. While individual cities around the nation have such policies, California is the first state to pass the law. On Wall Street today, midday, stocks are up. The Dow is up 95 points at 97.69. The NASDAQ is up 19 points at 19.34. And the S&P 500 is up 9 points at 10.27. It's 33 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young. Bill Delaney is away. It's Here and Now. President Bush has a busy week ahead of him, a trip to Asia with a fundraising stop in California and a visit with Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger, and a domestic PR campaign to win the hearts and minds of both the voting public and Washington lawmakers, considering an $87 billion price tag to rebuild Iraq. Two members of our D.C. roundtable join us from the Capitol. Andrea Stone covers Congress for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Robin.
Robin.
And Bill Douglas covers the White House for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Andrea, let's start with you and the PR campaign first. This week, the Bush administration is taking its case for its Iraq policy to local television stations and newspapers. Andrea, you spent the weekend in one of the most conservative districts in the nation. How is the president's request for $87 billion playing out there?
Well, I was in Muncie, Indiana, in the 6th District of Indiana, Mike Pence's district, and he's a very fiscal conservative, social conservative, and went around the district with him on Saturday and talking to people, and, you know, this is rock-ribbed Republican territory, and but even there, people were questioning whether or not we should just be giving the $20 billion for reconstruction as a grant, which is the president's preference, or as a loan that they would pay back using oil revenues at some point. And it was really interesting. You know, this is not a district that the Democrats have any hope of winning anytime soon. And yet people here, Republican Party officials, were just questioning, you know, whether we should be giving that money, especially this is an area that's lost a lot of manufacturing jobs, is still in a recession, and, you know, charity begins at home.
Well, you know, Bill, I want to bring you in on this. Andrea, I found the same thing last week traveling in New Hampshire. But as you say, and you write, even the most conservative voters in the nation are questioning the post-war in Iraq.
Right.
Bill, is that really that surprising? Because isn't the most conservative supporter of the president going to be for regime change, but not for nation building?
Well, it seems to be a surprise to the administration, which is why they've embarked on this campaign to educate or re-educate the public. The administration entered the war with a great deal of support, got a great deal of public support during the war. But the public was operating on a whole different set of principles, that the war would be done quickly, we'd have lots of help from an international coalition, both financially and militarily, and the public was not aware of the total price tag of what rebuilding Iraq would cost. So I think the administration is a bit surprised to see a bit of a change in the public view, because they've gotten such good support for the most part.
Yeah, and as we've noted, they've launched this public relations campaign, which is very well documented. That's what it is. But, Andrew, reports have surfaced of a letter campaign, letters appearing in local papers signed by soldiers saying the war effort is going well. Come to find out, these are form letters. And some of the soldiers in Iraq, when reached by their parents there, say, well, they didn't sign anything.
It's really interesting. The Pentagon is saying they had nothing to do with it. They're not. There's no coordinated campaign among the troops to send letters back home. But somebody is doing this. I mean, you don't get a form letter sent to small-town newspapers that are identical and all from the same unit, the 503rd Airborne Infantry Regiment. So I think, you know, whether this is part of what President Bush and his cabinet are trying to do in the coming weeks is a question, but it is kind of suspicious.
Mm. Well, we mentioned the big question is going to be whether the money given to Iraq will be in grants or loans that Iraq would pay back. The House defeated the payback idea. But, Bill, how is the Senate and the White House, how are they both going to be handling this?
Well, I mean, the White House just wants the money. I think that the administration would like to do this as grants, but If there's a battle, they'll take it any way they can get it at this stage in time.
But, Andrea, isn't the downside of loans, and we know that there's going to be some proposals in the Senate that the money be at least in part in loans, isn't the downside that other countries such as Russia and France, they have huge outstanding loans to Iraq? Aren't they less likely to forgive those loans if the U.S. is collecting on loans?
Well, that's certainly the argument that the White House is making, is that we're asking other countries at a donor conference next week to chip in, to give money for rebuilding, and here we are, you know, just making the debt even bigger. And another argument that the administration is making is that, you know, if we make loans and that's paid back by future oil revenues, doesn't that play into the critics who have said from the very start that this was not about, you know, toppling Saddam Hussein, but gaining control of Iraq's oil?
But the only problem with the oil revenue argument is part of the administration's initial thought in rebuilding Iraq was the use of oil revenues.
Right, and they're not pumping what they were hoping to. And there's another question, kind of a technical question, is like, who are you making the loan to? There's no sovereign government in Iraq yet. And part of the thing that I know that Mike Pence in Indiana was saying, well, why don't we make half of that? $10 billion we'll give them up front. And then maybe in 12 to 18 months, when there's a constitution and there's elections, then the second half, another $10 billion becomes loans that they, and by that time, hopefully, the oil is pumping. But, you know, the White House is going to try to stand its ground, and I think they have a good chance of winning.
Well, Bill, you just mentioned the mixed messages. And as we've seen, that's continuing with, for instance, Vice President Dick Cheney saying one thing about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and President Bush saying another. On television yesterday, the Republican chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Richard Lugar, criticized the president's lack of leadership. He pretty much said President Bush has to get his act together. How's that statement this past week going to play out this coming week?
Well, the administration did agree to go on this campaign to go over the media's head, to go over particularly newspapers, to state their case directly to the public. But the public has heard three different things from three different people, from the president, from Condoleezza Rice, and from Vice President Cheney about the war. So that's where Senator Lugar's argument comes in about leadership. I'm sure his comments probably didn't go over big at the White House. One thing the White House likes to do is point out that President Bush is the commander-in-chief, and one of the complaints administration officials have is that the president gets too little credit for leading things.
But, you know, Senator Lugar has been a critic even before. You know, he said, well, what is the plan? What is the exit strategy? And so this is kind of in line with him questioning, you know, as head of the Foreign Relations Committee, he feels like he's not as much in the loop as he should be.
He also said that the war effort is going to cost $50 billion more than the $87 billion requested, and it will last as long as 8 years.
Yeah, I think the American, you know, this is something that the White House needs to explain, is that we're not going to be out of there right away. I mean, look at Bosnia. We're still there. It's 8 years, actually, that we're in Bosnia. So this is a long-term proposition, and there's going to be a lot more money to be spent.
Mm-hmm. Well, one last note. Democratic candidate Dennis Kucinich is formally declaring his candidacy today. He'll be hitting the hustings. His in Ohio. Andrew, you were out on those hustings this weekend as well. We just want to ask before we let you go, how was the hog roast?
The hog roast was fabulous, although it was on Wonder Bread, so I was kind of disappointed. But
Did they put it on Wonder Bread?
Wonder Bread rolls, yes.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
Bill Douglas, White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today, members of our D.C. roundtable. Still to come, some great tribute albums are out. Question is, why buy one when you can just download, however illegally, your favorite songs? You're listening to Here and Now. Game 3 of the Boston Red Sox-New York Yankees-American League Championship Series was more of a smackdown than a ball game. Pedro Martinez pitched a little too close to Kareem Garcia's cranium, then seemed to gesture he'd get another player in the head. A Yankee practically tackled Red Sox second baseman Todd Walker. New York's Roger Clemens brushed back a Red Sox player who stormed the mound along with everyone else, except Yankees pitching coach and former Red Sox coach Don Zimmer, who headed for Pedro, who deflected him to the ground, leading to this line in the New York Times: Pedro Martinez threw 98 pitches and one 72-year-old bench coach. Let's not forget the dust-up in the Yankee bullpen, which sent a Fenway Park groundskeeper to the hospital with cleat marks on his back and may lead to criminal charges against two Yankee players. Whew, last night's rainout was like a grade school timeout. It sent both teams back to their corners to repeat, I will not fight in class. Joining us on the line now is David Kindred. He's columnist for the Sporting News. David, what a weekend.
Boy, I guess.
I mean,
you know, I was just glad that I don't play baseball anymore.
Right, it's dangerous business. Put this in perspective for us. The Yankees players Dave Nelson and Kareem Garcia may face criminal charges. New York's Mayor Bloomberg, a Massachusetts native, by the way, wants Pedro arrested. Is this more than the normal baseball brawl?
I don't think it's more than the normal. Certainly reaction is more than the normal. Bloomberg, I think, said that he'd have him arrested had that happened in Yankee Stadium. There's no way he'd have him arrested. No arrest is going to come of what happened in the bullpen because the stories will be tremendously divergent. But this is an old thing in baseball, and there's no doubt that Pedro was throwing at Garcia's head.
Yeah, he said when he was gesturing to another player by tapping his Pedro's temple that he was just saying, what, he'd remember?
Yeah, you know, that's just silly. I mean, in baseball, if you want to hit a player in the head, you throw behind his head because the instinctive move is backwards. Garcia is just lucky that he happened to have leaned forward. It was a vile and vicious thing that Martinez did, and he should have been thrown from the game immediately because his control is good enough. He throws the ball exactly where he wants it every time.
Well, now, Red Sox fans, some of them at least, are saying that, you know, Roger Clemens for the Yankees, well, as Dan Shaughnessy in the Globe today says, was a big baby at one time, too. Dan does go on to say that Pedro was an embarrassment. But what's going to happen now?
Well, I think that they'll settle down. I think the commissioner's office did the right thing. And you'll notice that the Gordon Eads in the Globe today reported that Martinez was fined $50,000. Ramirez was fined $25,000. Garcia fined $10,000. And that was not for anything to do with the beanball incident. But Garcia left the field to go into the bullpen to join the fight out there. And Zimmer properly was fined $5,000 because he instigated the thing with Martinez.
And we should say Don Zimmer has given a teary public apology for that. But any thoughts on how this sort of smackdown over the weekend is going to affect goodwill towards the Red Sox?
Well, I don't think it can do them any good. I mean, one of the New York papers, I guess the New York Post, said you have Martinez, Fenway, Punk. I'm just rooting for someone to come out of that series alive to play the Cubs.
Oh, and the Cubs, that's right. They're playing as well. They lost last night to the Florida Marlins. That series stands at 3-2. Any sense, not who's the better fighter, but who's the better team?
Well, I think the Yankees are the better team in that series, and I believe the Cubs are the better team, at least the better pitching team. And we want the Cubs. My mother and I want the Cubs in the World Series, and either the Yankees or the Red Sox will suit us fine.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
All right, Robin, thank you.
You know where my heart is.
All right.
David Kindred, columnist for the Sporting News, speaking to us from Virginia. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In addition to a spate of box sets from mega platinum stars, pop music has recently seen a surge in tribute CDs. Usually this involves a variety of singers doing another act's catalog. For instance, a country version of Eagles hits went to the top 10 a few years ago, and that prompted the original band to reunite and tour again. Well, our music critic Tim Riley is here to talk about the tribute genre and how it indirectly affects the current downloading controversy. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine.
Let's start with some music.
I can see you disappointed by the way you look at me, and I'm sorry if I'm not the woman you thought I'd be. Yes.
Okay, so can you tell who this is?
Yes. I mean, that's Dolly Parton. It's
right.
Everyone knows Dolly Parton.
It's Dolly Parton singing her own song, Just Because I'm a Woman. Now, she's been making bluegrass records lately, but this is a tribute album to Dolly Parton, a songwriter. Not many people know what a good songwriter she is.
And it's the only track here where Dolly sings. The other tracks are made up of admirers like Emmylou Harris and Norah Jones and Shelby Lynn. It's a typical tribute production in that it's got all of the usual suspects for a tribute record, plus some ringers like Michelle Indigocello and Sinead O'Connor. But the standout track for me is a very famous singer, and I'm really curious to see if you recognize her in this context.
As she told a story from the Bible she had read about a coat of many colors Joseph wore, and then she said, perhaps this coat will bring you good luck and happiness. And I just couldn't wait to wear it, and Mama blessed it with a kiss. And my coat of many colors that my mama made for me,
well, now I think I can hear Alison Krauss in there.
Yes, that is Shania Twain duetting with Alison Krauss.
Anything you can do to get Shania Twain.
Well, I'm a big Shania booster. What can I say? But it confirms my theory that what Shania needs to do is be radical and make a country western record. It's a gorgeous track, and it's a whole new take on that song, which Dolly Parton is rightfully famous for, Coat of Many Colors, but also that Shania Twain can sing a sensitive country song backed up by a bluegrass band and sound quite good.
Well, it is beautiful, and it reminds us that tribute albums give artists a chance to be in somebody else's shoes for a second.
That's right.
So who else has been, you know, flattered by a tribute CD?
Well, the other CD I brought down is a tribute to Bruce Springsteen. It's called Light of Day, and it's a charity project towards cancer research. And this project is impressive not just because of the huge range of material that we get from the Springsteen catalog, the range of things that he writes about and the range of styles, but how well songs from, like, Nebraska and Tunnel of Love hold up over time. My particular favorite from this collection is by Dion of Dion and the Belmonts, and here he is singing Book of Dreams.
I'm standing in the backyard listening to the party inside. Tonight I'm drinking in forgiveness this life provides. The scars we carry remain, but the pain slips away, it seems. Oh, won't you, baby, in my book of dreams.
I am thrown back several years. It reminds me, I want to hear more of Dion. That's beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Who else is on this
record? Well, we've got, I think, standout numbers from Patty Griffin, Elvis Costello, Billy Bragg, and also a bunch of artists that you may not have heard of. It's a very good and interesting collection because it approaches a lot of different Springsteen songs from a lot of different angles.
But what do you think in general of the tributes?
Well, the problem with these tribute albums is that they tend to be, as a rule, inconsistent. You have your standout tracks, and then you have a lot of other tracks, either by unknown or major artists trying to do something that really just isn't working, and they're not pulling it off. And so you wind up liking maybe three or four tracks from the whole album, and the rest of them you don't listen to. So I take the whole tribute album genre as a good reason to go and download a lot of this stuff for free. Figure out which tracks you want and go look for them on the web.
Okay, here's where the plot thickens, because as you well know, Tim, downloading is illegal. The warrants have gone out.
Yeah, well, I think of the music industry this way. It's kind of like a huge cruise ship that has sprung 1,000 leaks. And the industry's answer is to try and go in and plug up every single leak, when there's all of these free lifeboats out there that people are hitching rides on, and there's no need. It's like, get a new boat. There's no need to fix all these leaks. The leaks are irrelevant now. Well, the boat is sinking.
Well, as you know, they're in court trying to fix the leaks. So let's put aside the legal process and talk about technology, the new boats, as you say, that might make the current legal battles moot anyway.
Well, the courts are going to decide some of these things. But this month, there are two big things that are going to happen that really be worth paying attention to. And that is, Apple is going to launch its iTunes Music Store for Windows users. And Apple has launched the only successful online downloading store, getting people to pay for downloads. That's been successful. Apple has figured out how to do it, and now it's going to become available for Windows users, and I think it's going to be very successful, and I think it's going to turn a lot of heads. The second thing is, Apple has a new compression format, which is called AAC, for advanced audio compression, and it really makes these sound files much smaller without sacrificing any of the fidelity. So I thought we could measure a couple different the same track, one using regular CD sound and the other using advanced audio compression, and I really dare you to hear a difference between the two.
Okay, which track would it be?
We're going to listen to Elvis Costello do a country version of Bruce Springsteen's Brilliant Disguise. The first is the regular CD.
So tell me what I see when I look into your eyes. Is that you, baby, or just a brilliant disguise?
Okay, so that was regular CD sound, and now here's Apple's new AAC format.
So tell me what I see when I look into your eyes. Is that you, baby, or just a brilliant disguise?
Wow. You can't tell the difference.
I defy someone to tell the difference between those two.
So are you saying, Tim, as some others have said, that the music industry as we know it is over? If you like a tribute CD, you will, perhaps with these new innovations, pay for it to go on and just take the cuts that you like from the CD.
Exactly. And then more and more consumers are coming around to this common sense way of thinking, which is why pay $18 for 10 to 12 tracks where you may only like half of them, when you could just pay $3 or $4 for the four tracks that you like?
Well, in the meantime, many of us will buy the tribute albums at the store. Give us a favorite tribute album to go out with.
My favorite tribute album of all time is Willie Nelson's To Lefty from Willie, where he sings all Lefty Frizzell songs. Mm-hmm. This is a song called Look What Thoughts Will Do. He did it in 1975, and it's been remastered and reissued along with the rest of his catalog to celebrate his 70th birthday.
But today you say we're through. Just look what thoughts will do. Now another wears the crown, and you think you have found just what makes your world go round. Watch those thoughts, they'll get you down.
It really is one of the great all-time tribute albums where we hear a classic singer singing some classic songs by a classic songwriter.
The honky-tonk legend Lefty Frizzell, as done by Willie. Everything old is new again. Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
Here and Now's rock and pop critic, Tim Riley. His book, Tell Me Why, A Beatles Commentary, is out in paperback. For more information about tribute CDs, visit our website, here-now.org.
You and I thought you loved me too, but today you say we're through. Now just look what thoughts will do.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now. Internet worms and viruses, what you can do to protect your computer. And from yard sales to thrift stores, a look at America's love affair with secondhand stuff. That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.